I think we will do Martin and Brian. If you don't mind, stand next to us so we can, you can all see it rather than just sit there. We're going to use the time, a bit more informal question and answer. You've got a short time, folks, so we'll get to the point answers from the guys, but let's use it. I mean, that was inspirational for both of them. You feel it. The energy in the room is powerful. So, who's first?
I would like to ask Martin, what is the problem about CAs coming into asset management? Because I would have thought for an asset manager like yourself, hiring a CA was much less risky than hiring a bright young thing from Oxbridge that may or may not work out.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, I think the thing that's changed is there isn't really what I would term a graduate program anymore in financial services. It's an internship program. So we take on maybe 30 grads a year, and they've all come through they've all been interns the year before. So it really stacks. It really makes it difficult for a qualified chartered accountant to join us. And as I say, 20 years ago, all fund, you know, a lot of the fund managers were. One this year resigned his job, became an intern for 6 weeks in the hope that he might get on the grad scheme. And he got on, which was great. I was very pleased, obviously, to take a risk like that. But that's the issue now. So I think we've got to find, and I was speaking to Anton about it, we've got to find a way of getting them into the business, allowing them to get into the business and do some training in the business or do internships in the business or whatever, and just see if we can't get more back into it. But it has changed over the last 15, 20 years when we joined.
Thanks, Tim. Next. You both operate in very regulated industries. What's the one piece of regulation that could change?
Brian,
more than
first.
What I expect.
Brian first.
I think that in the railways we could really do with a different model. And I would have very radical views about that. I think that we're still very much bound by regulation. I think on the buses there's a reasonable degree of deregulation, and I think we've got that bit right. But I think on the railways, I would break the asset network rail up as an asset and go for operator-based franchises and do it quite differently. But we haven't found a politician with the ball to do that.
The obvious franchise to do it with is ScotRail.
Yeah.
I mean, with a single, there's a single operator in ScotRail with a couple coming in, so that's the obvious one to test it with. In financial services, I don't know, we're highly regulated. I think we just have to live with it. I think the unintended consequences of the regulation is it's raised the barriers of entry, which I don't think they intended, so it's actually reduced competition in the sector. Because it's just too hard now to start up with all the regulation. You may have to ask a question.
I will keep this going. Everything. Yes, that's great.
You both started your businesses small, so there's that element of entrepreneurship that you have. But as you grow, they become far more institutionalized. So how do you keep that element of flair and entrepreneurship there with a business that's growing even ever more institutionalized?
Well, that's a very good question. I think the best example of someone that's managed to do this is actually Virgin Group, which is amazing because Richard's actually got tens of thousands of people working for him, but it's all like as if he's a personal friend and they all want to work for Richard, which is quite amazing. I have not been able to achieve that, but there is a couple of, I think, of rules of thumb with this that are important. I mean, first of all, I think a style of leadership, you've got to be out on the job. And we run the whole of Stagecoach Group based on doing site visits. So we don't summons people to Perth. We go out and meet them at the depots and at the companies around the country and at the railway companies or whatever it is that they're working. I think the other key to this is to have a very short chain of command. And I've worked quite hard at that over the years to make sure that you don't have burgeoning middle management groups and too many people that have got advisory roles but actually don't have any responsibility for anything. They're just a pest, really. So I really like, if someone's going to give me advice about something, the next thing is I'm likely to ask them to go and do it. to actually go and do it, you know. And that's always an acid test, isn't it, you know. And so I've kept a really short chain of command in the bus company Paris Station Coach, which is, I think, one of the reasons why the division does such high margins and works so well.
I think that's the key, Brian, is short levels of command. I think that's the key. I think at Tesco, isn't it, it's sort of four levels, I would say. And that's what we try and do in asset management, is have really, say, four, maximum five levels. And the other thing we do here is we don't allow people to have their own offices. Everyone has to work open plan. And I think that helps as well, because it just doesn't give the impression of status or the corner office or any of that sort of stuff. Although I do sit in the corner of the dealing room, you know. So, but no, I think it's the short levels of command are clear, and just being accessible. And as Brian says, going round the business as well is really interesting in the transport business, I think, because there is no real headquarters, is there? I mean, the headquarters are the various operations, and I remember someone saying in the transport business, not that I should be speaking about the transport business, but clearly I know more than Brian about it, so I will. You've got to identify in the transport business who the key person in the chain is. So if you've got a school bus depot in the US, the key person in that industry is the person who runs that depot in our school bus operations. And I think that's key, isn't it? Identifying who the key person in the chain of command is as well, or the... But no, keep it as short as possible and be as accessible as possible.
Good, Jeff. My question is more about your individual transition from the profession to becoming an entrepreneur and going ahead and building such great companies. Obviously, you became qualified but then found yourselves as individuals becoming entrepreneurs and building these companies. How did that happen? Was it circumstance? Obviously, it's up to the individual having that entrepreneur. But were there other circumstances, as you reflect back, that
wrote
these
two? Right. Well, for me, really, it was just circumstantial. I mean, the law changed, and Margaret Thatcher got it in 1979. She deregulated express coach services. So for me, if I hadn't done it then, I would have missed that opportunity. And actually, the timing was good in some respects, since I had finished my apprenticeship, I'd got my qualifications, and that was me just finishing my apprenticeship with Arthur Anderson. But by that time, I actually quite liked the job, and you know, I was kind of swithering about what I should do, really. But the transport opportunity really excited me, because even when I was at Arthur Anderson, I didn't actually tell anyone this at the time, but I still kept my job on the buses at the weekend, which I'm not really supposed to do. It was all right until somebody punched me up on a Saturday night and nearly broke my nose, and my face was all gashed, you know, and then I sort of confessed to Eric that I actually was moonlighting on the buses. So I never really kind of got away from my transport interest as well. So for me, it just was a never never kind of thing. And actually, the plan, seizing was part of our contingency plan, because the plan was, if it didn't work out, I would go to Saudi Arabia and work as an accountant, because you're not paying tax there, and I would send the money back so that Anne's house wouldn't get repossessed, because she put her house up to the bank, and I put a big injection of my savings in. So, you know, it was part of my fallback plan. And just finally, when I left Arthur Anderson, they were quite happy for me to take on a couple of clients who I had done the audit on. And one of them was Black Gold Oil Tool in Aberdeen, and there was another, Crombie Fabrications in Aberdeen. And I actually did did accounting work for them, and I trained their bookkeepers to do the work in progress and then to do the whole balance sheet and everything, and made myself redundant. But Arthur Anderson was very happy for me to do that, because it meant that they made the audit a bit easier. So that was CA's been a great fallback for me.
I suppose there was no chance of any Arthur Anderson partners being on the buses on the Saturday night. So you were pretty safe, actually. I don't know. I mean, I was much the same as just luck, being in the right place at the right time. Someone said to me, "Do you want to be a fund manager?" And I really had no idea what a fund manager... I mean, I roughly knew what it was, but in those days, really, in the early in the early 80s. It wasn't the massive business it is today. And it's an industry that's grown exponentially over the last sort of 30 years. And what I did was, in those days, all asset managers in Scotland were either had been or were part of accountancy or law firms. And that's what people don't actually really understand, the history of the Scottish fund management industry. They were all, you know, Ivory and Syme, all of them were law or accountancy. And we were part of a law firm in Aberdeen. And I'd done an MA in accountancy, which took 3 years. And I thought, I don't really want to leave university. So I thought, what else can I do? So I thought, I'll do a law degree. And luckily for me, I did this MA-LLB, which took 5 years. And then I did my CA. So by this stage, I've done 8 years of struggling. I failed my part two, Brian. I'm impressed you passed yours, actually. That's pretty good. And then this fund management firm was part of a law firm. So they were looking for an accountant with a law degree. So that was how I got in. And then we bought ourselves out in 83. And then just built the business from, as I say, three of us in a room in Aberdeen to, you know, this big business today. But it's just, it's luck. I mean, it's being in the right place at the right time a lot of the time. And then, as Brian says, using your CA qualification to take advantage of it. And I think that's the key. The other two guys I started the business with were lawyers. And it was just inevitable that I sort of took the lead role in managing the business. I was actually a useless fund manager as well. It's quite interesting. I managed to take the UK Growth Fund, which I managed, to bottom of the 250 growth funds in the UK. And you know, you couldn't do that if you tried, actually. So it was a unique achievement. And my colleague said, you've got to give this up, Martin. There's going to be nothing left if you keep managing money. So I manage the fund managers, which I find the enjoyable bit of the business. You know, managing the talent in our business is the key thing.
Thank you.
Yes. Both you gentlemen have been in position 30 years. How do you know when it's the right time to retire? Alex Ferguson he got his timing pretty good. How do you see that?
Well, Brian's got his pretty well, hasn't he? I mean, yeah. I mean, he's been retired for a while, Brian. So.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, there was one of my UK bus managers who started as a trolley bus conductor in Bradford. And I mean, he's an amazing guy. You'd never get this guy a job at interview. He smokes about 80 Woodbine and wears a cardigan. And but actually, he's a fantastic bus manager. And I thought, when Les retires, I was thinking about it, and then he had been wondering when he was going to go, and he decided when he was going to go. I thought, if I stay on now, I'm just going to get back involved in all this detail, and I'm just going to, you know, because I can't help myself. So I said, this is the time for me to step back, and there's a whole group of people, highly capable, but they needed some oxygen and some airspace to go on with it, because Les and I slightly suffocated them, I think. And I think that's going to work really well. But for me, that was the final thing that kind of swung it. I thought, this is a sensible time to put new person in place. And Martin really was ready to do the job, you know. It's smelling like my story about, you know, black gold oil till, you know. And I was delighted when the bookkeeper could do all the work. And there's part of this thing, isn't it? If you're not got a too fragile an ego, you should be quite happy as part of a succession plan to say, right, this is the time now to move on, let somebody else have a go at it. And I just feel the time is right for me. Now, I get my fix by doing stuff at Suture Investments, because I need to do this creative bus thing. So I started a company in Poland, which has been great fun, you know. So, you know, that keeps me busy enough to keep me occupied and out of the house enough to not annoy the wife.
I think it's the most difficult thing probably to gauge when you should go. A lot of people stay too long. I had the situation in First Group where the CEO probably stayed a year or two too long. And it's very difficult to actually get your timing right. I made that fatal blunder of saying I would go when Alec Ferguson did. So I've now had to change my stance. But I found a CEO in the US who's 92, of a public company. So there's a bit of time left, you know. Yeah, so. But it's a really difficult, difficult thing. In fact, I was speaking to Hugh Young about it this week. I said, we'll probably be retired rather than retire, you know. So, and I think that's what happens in our business: is you make a huge mistake, and someone has to take the flak for it. So, yeah, but it's difficult.
Greenspan was still running the Fed when he was 83.
I mean, as an entrepreneur, since there are some questions, the one on regulation earlier, what are your thoughts on the government requirements in terms of companies? To some sense, just think you just want to go on with running the business. Sometimes you've got all these quite burdensome regulations, particularly on government. That's what you're trying to do, cheering up on.
I'm really not a very good chairman in that respect.
He's never bothered with governance, have you, Brian?
I'm always a bit of an anarchist. My deputy chairman makes sure that I do all the right things. So when it comes to governance, I just do what I'm told by other people. So we're actually highly compliant for the most part. But entrepreneurs and corporate governance don't sit comfortably side by side, just to be honest.
I think, I can look at it from both sides as an investor in a company and obviously the CEO of a company. I actually think it's a pretty good discipline for people like us to have to adhere to all these governance regulations, because there'd be a temptation if we didn't have strong non-execs or strong chairman to sort of really over-influence or have too much influence in a business. So I think it's quite a good check and balance for people to actually say, are you sure you're doing the right thing? And then looking at it from an investor's point of view, they're highly suspicious of companies such as ours, because in a way they do like them, but they also are very wary of these long-term CEOs that have been there and the how much influence they exert on the business. So I think it's good. I mean, I really think it's important that I'm a great believer in separating the chairman and chief executive role, unlike, you know, in the US where they're often combined, and I think that's a real corporate governance disaster for someone to occupy both roles. But I also think in businesses like Brian's and banks, I think the only people that can be the chairman are someone who has worked in the business, because you see the disaster of bringing in outsiders into these highly complicated, highly regulated businesses. And if someone came in as chairman of say Stagecoach, they have no idea of the running of the regulations, the running of the business, the nuances. And it is interesting, Brian, isn't it? In Stagecoach, you really need a chairman who devotes a lot of time to the business because of the external factor, the government work and all this sort of stuff. There's a lot of work with the Department for Transport and so on. I think it helps if you've got chairmen who are pretty strong and have a great knowledge of the business as well.
You mentioned that it's how you bounce back from failure that defines you. What's your biggest setback on your way to where you want now?
Well, I mean, I there's a theory that no CEO survives a 90% fall in the share price. I managed 95%, so. I was lucky. I mean, this was the split caps that almost brought us down. I mean, our market cap went from $1 billion to $50 million and now back up to $5 billion. So you can see, but it was an enormous setback. I mean, it completely wrecked our business. And once you get into that sort of spiral of politicians, once the politicians and journalists start, the regulators follow. The regulators very seldom lead a sort of an issue. It's the journalists and politicians that get the regulators in, and that's what happened with us. The regulators knew there was, you know, nothing wrong had happened, apart from people losing money, which was unfortunate, of course. But But as Brian says, it then took us 2.5 years of battling to get out of this hole that we had dug ourselves into, really was at one point we'd 50 million market cap and 250 million of debt. Today we're sitting at 5 billion market cap and 300-400 million of cash. So it's been an enormous turnaround in the business. Brian, are you going to talk about America?
Well, your kids bonding well with their social worker. We made a fundamental error in how we'd gone about things, really, when we did this big American deal that blew the whole company up.
We were the underbidder, by the way. So.
Yeah. Always quite interesting, yes, I know. Anyway, it was. I had always followed some reasonably fundamental principles or sort of checks and balances with doing transactions. I used to always like to get a lot of assets in the deal and try to minimize the goodwill bridge. And so we began to, I don't know what the expression would be, but we began to believe our own publicity or propaganda or whatever. And I mean, this was an enormous goodwill bridge on this transaction in particular. And up to then, I always used to kind of look at it and say, well, we can fund a bit of goodwill, but I don't want this thing to be predominantly goodwill, right? Because if you've got an asset, at least you've got something you can sell, or you can break up, you can do something with, And I would even just remember doing a deal in Portugal and the partners were and looking down a schedule of assets and saying, well, I'll take that, And one of the things when you're dealing with foreigners, you have to watch is if you give them something you can just answer yes or no to, you don't always know what you've got. So I said, is that a trolleybus depot? And they said, yes. I said, I'll take it, you see? And then after it, I said to Keith, it'd be better to see what this we've actually bought up in Sintra, So we got in a car and went away up to Sintra, and we had actually bought a tram depot and 14 kilometres of tramway right up into the middle of Sintra, right? And it was full of tram cars, some of which were from 1903 and were still in pristine condition. It was amazing. Anyway, we kind of went past that old-fashioned way of looking at things and thought, we've got fantastic PE, we can do this deal, right? And there was a fair amount of pressure on us to keep the earnings thing going as well, people were suggesting at a point we should take over British Airways because it was reasonably managed, but we thought we were so much better than British Airways that we could run the airline. That's how crazy it was, right? And sometimes we've got to just pinch ourselves and just a minute, let's have a wee reality check here. And we really were needing a reality check, and we got a big reality check with that transaction. It was very clear to me after we'd done the deal that there was fundamental issues that weren't right about it, and that we had done the wrong transaction, and that we needed a structural solution to fix it. Which eventually we ended up doing. So our story is our share price came down to 12 pence, and I think we closed last night at 3.36 or whatever. So, and we've also handed a ton of cash back in the process. So I think, I don't know which one of us is Lazarus. Maybe we're both Lazarus.
No time. Sorry, folks. I know that you've all got to head back to work, but I'd just like to take a time just for a few closing comments. This has been absolutely fantastic. It has been inspirational, humorous, insightful. You don't get this very often, ladies and gentlemen. And you young ones or students who think, this is happening every week in ICAS. Yes, it does. This is the way it is every week. Just like to say, before I give a few final words on the guys, just like to talk about us. We have the whole range here just now, and we're delighted Jim Pettigrew, who's Vice President of the Institute. You'll see Jim a lot more when he becomes President. He's on Martin's board at Aberdeen Asset, as it happens. But there are young guys here, and I'm looking around the audience just now. Some of you, you're looking at me in the eye just now, some of you are going to be very successful entrepreneurs. You just need a shove sometimes, or you need a help. One of the things that we've been doing in the Institute recently is providing mentoring for the guys that have the itch, the knot in the stomach, the idea, there's something bubbling, saying, I don't know what to do with it. Remember, Jim, you remember a couple of years ago, we had a breakfast event for students in Browns. Fantastic. This young guy came up to me and he said, Anton, I've got an idea. I don't know what to do with it. He said, I've just qualified in Ernst & Young. I was in holiday Kuala Lumpur. Every night I used to sit drinking in the rooftop bars and I loved it. Loved it. And the way home on a plane, I couldn't sleep. He thought, wouldn't it be great to have a rooftop bar in London? And he said, I've been making inquiries, some guys have probably, he says, I think I can do it. He says, I just need a bit of help. Gave up to Jim. He met with Jim maybe once or twice. The boy is up and running. He's buying rooftops. He's still in his 20s. He's buying up rooftops of old buildings where you've got a nice view and it's sitting empty. You build a lift. He's doing really well. All he needed was a nudge and a bit of help. We've provided the training, the expertise. It's other members that can give you the courage. Hearing these guys today gives you the courage to take the next. I loved your question. But you maybe get something in there saying, I need the courage to take that step. If you're sitting here just now saying, I've not got all the courage, email me or phone me. And I will get you with someone as a mentor who will help you take that step. A lot of senior guys have been in touch saying, Anton, I've been successful. Let me give something back and mentor these young guys. So if you want help, get in touch with me. If you're not sure where to phone, just phone the office and we'll do it. Last point just now. Some of you here for the first time today. Fantastic. It's not the last. Okay? We're building families. We're building communities all over the world. We will have, by next week, 20 active communities around the world. Monday, I launch Geneva. Tuesday, Paris. All the CAs in Paris have come together on Tuesday for dinner, all of them in Geneva. Zurich will be coming up fairly soon. North America's pretty much done. Australia, Asia's pretty much there. They're all over the world. Your community, ladies and gentlemen, is in London where we have thousands of CAs. And you will be inundated with emails all the time to come to, let me say, family events. Come to the family event. That is your family, your professional family, for the rest of your life. And my advice is, particularly the young, this is it. This is made in heaven for you guys in terms of your career and your own development. So please, please, please make use of it. So ladies and gentlemen, just to say thank you once again, I hope we'll be able to have more opportunities with Martin and Brian. And we wish you both success as role models for the Institute, but also as global businessmen who are great examples and who live the values of all that we believe in ICANN. So ladies and gentlemen, Martin and Brian, thank you.